You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. To take the bright silver and gold you had taken from somebody
else. And this we go right here. Thank you. Now, we've all heard the oil industry and the coal industry and their indentured servants in the political process telling us that global climate stability is a luxury that we can't afford, that we have to choose now between economic prosperity on the one hand and environmental protection on the other. And that is a false choice. In 100% of the situations, good environmental policy is identical to good economic policy. If we want to measure our economy, and this is how we ought to be measuring it, based upon how it produces jobs and the dignity of jobs over the generations, how it preserves the values of the assets of our community, and how it averts the catastrophe of global warming. If, on the other hand, we want to do what they've been urging us to do on Capitol Hill, which is to treat the planet as if it were a business in liquidation, convert our natural resources to cash as quickly as possible, have a few years of pollution-based prosperity, we can generate an instantaneous cash flow and the illusion of a prosperous economy, but our children are going to pay for our joyride with denuded landscapes, with poor health, with huge cleanup costs, and with climate chaos, which is going to amplify over time and that they will never be able to pay. Environmental injury is deficit spending. It's a way of loading the costs of our generation's prosperity onto the backs of our children. Climate change is upon us, its impacts are going to be catastrophic, and we are causing it. The good news is we have the scientific and technological capacity to avert its most catastrophic impacts. We only need the political will. If we raise fuel economy standards in our automobiles by 1 mile per gallon, we generate twice the amount of oil that's in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. If we raise fuel economy standards by 7.6 miles per gallon, we yield more oil than we now import from the Persian Gulf. We could eliminate 100% of Persian Gulf oil. Think about what that would do for our economy, for our foreign policy, for our global leadership. It would dramatically improve our balance of payments, reduce our national debt, and make all of us more prosperous and more independent, and spare us from wars in the Mideast that are costing us already $1 trillion, and from entanglements with Mideastern dictators who despise democracy and are hated by their own people. Now, you've heard today a lot of people say that there are many little things that you all can do to avert climate change on your own. But I will tell you this. It is more important than buying compact fluorescent light bulbs or then buying a fuel-efficient automobile. The most important thing you can do is to get involved in the political process and get rid of all these rotten politicians that we have in Washington, D.C. who are nothing more than corporate toadies for companies like Exxon and Southern Company, these villainous companies that consistently put their private financial interest ahead of American interest and ahead of the interest of all of humanity. This is treason, and we need to start treating them now as traitors. And they have their slick public relations firms and their phony think tanks in Washington, D.C., and their crooked scientists who are lying to the American people day after day after day. And we have a press that has completely let down American democracy. That's giving us Anna Nicole Smith and Paris Hilton instead of the issues that we need to understand to make rational decisions in a democracy, like global warming. And so I'm going to tell you this, that the next time you see John Stossel or Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity, these flat earthers, these corporate toadies lying to you, lying to the American public, and telling you that global warming doesn't exist, you send an email to their advertisers and tell them you're not going to buy their products anymore. And I want you to remember this, that we are not protecting the environment for the sake of the fishes and the birds. We're protecting it because nature is the infrastructure of our communities. And if we want to meet our obligation as a generation, as a civilization, as a nation, which is to create communities for our children that provide them with the same opportunities for dignity and enrichment and good health and prosperity and stability as the communities that our parents gave us, we've got to start by protecting our environmental infrastructure. The air we breathe, the water we drink, the wildlife, the public lands, the things that connect us to our past, to our history, that provide context to our communities, and that are the source, ultimately, of our values and our virtues and our character as a people and the future of our children. And I will see all of you on the barricades.
That was environmental attorney and journalist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speaking at the recent Live Earth concert. That clip has been making its way around the internet and has generated a lot of enthusiasm. Others, of course, consider it wildly radical. In my opinion, it does not go far enough, because it does not get to the heart of the matter. That the conservatives are right about one thing: there is a conflict between saving the environment and saving the capitalist economic system. While speakers such as Al Gore are trying to woo corporations with the promise of green profits, the first guest on our program tonight will urge us to say good riddance to bad rubbish. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The economic system that now increasingly dominates the globe is based on churning out an endless stream of products, much of them useless, redundant, poorly made, or downright harmful. The creation of an expansive notion of private property has separated people from the means of subsistence and forced them into jobs to earn money. To question that basic paradigm is considered lunacy. If that be lunacy, let's make the best of it. We are a society of miserable people because we've been given a series of Hobson's choices, such as take the toxic factory in your community or starve. The point is that were the factory owner forced to live beside the toxic waste he produces, things would change. The political economic battle lines underlying the question of our environment come into focus in what has been called the Green Scare. We'll look at that in depth this week also, and then conclude with the next installment from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto that has been examining the system of compulsory schooling as a means for the production of profitable human units. A reminder for Finger Lakes residents who want to fight toxic corporate incursions in their own communities through the resurgence of local democracy. Tom Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund and founder of Democracy Schools will be speaking tomorrow night at the Rural Urban Center in Montour Falls. The talk begins at 7 p.m. The Rural Urban Center is located at 208 Broadway, just off Route 14. A donation of $10 is being requested to cover expenses. So let's get on with the show. Our first offering comes to us courtesy of Resonance FM Radio in London.
Welcome to the Low Carbon Show, where this week we're talking to Tom Hodgkinson, editor and co-founder of the Idler magazine, which describes itself as the periodical of easy living. He's also the author of two books, How to Be Idle and How to Be Free. Making the transition to a low carbon society necessitates a fresh look at the skills we have and the jobs that we do. What activities are going to be most valuable in a world without fossil fuels? How will we organise ourselves in a world that is less wasteful, more local, and more about self-sufficiency and community resilience? What interested me in talking to Tom Hodgkinson was the fact that the ideas he had been exploring about freedom and a life of leisure matched increasingly closely to some of the visions that are emerging of what our low-carbon future will look like. In a sense, Tom has been beavering away on the development of a philosophical justification and a historical precedent for environmentally friendly lifestyles. The first question I asked him was when he noticed this convergence.
The point about idleness and being ecologically aware, the connection really struck me when a guy, Stephen Harding from Dartington, read a piece for The Idler, and we called it How to Save the Planet Without Really Trying. Hmm. And it struck me that, and him, that part of the problem is actually the interfering in the doing. So his argument was that a far more sort of efficient and also more pleasurable response was to stop doing so much, not just driving cars, but doing anything at all. And the most effective thing you can really do is to kind of stop completely and go and lie on the hillside. I mean, it's one kind of slight problem I've got with the green movement as a whole, is that it seems to have the same language, if you like, as what it's opposing. Mm. So you quite often get the idea of, you know, something must be done, mm. whereas our idea is actually a lot less should be done.
Mm. I mean, I've got a... I must admit, I guess, to having a kind of puritanical streak and being... looking for kind of a kind of government lead on the one hand, but also thinking, well, yeah, actually doing less and kind of consuming less is kind of one of the fastest ways to... reducing your kind of carbon footprint as well, I guess.
Yeah, but also, I think the puritanical streak in the green movement is something that we should be a bit wary of.
Mm.
Because from my reading that was behind my second book, How to Be Free, I laid the blame of a lot of the predicament that we're in on a sort of Puritan mindset, which essentially was a big change from the medieval mindset. The medieval mindset was more providence-based, if you like. So that, you know, it's like Christ, Sermon on the Mount, consider the lilies of the field, they toil not, neither do they spin. And it was the idea that you just kind of, you know, bundle along. And when you start taking your fate into your own hands in a sort of Dr. Faustus type way, that's when things start going wrong for the individual and for the planet. And, yeah. and the other, one other objection to the sort of puritanical strain is that it can be seen as being anti-pleasure. And the Puritans were suspicious of pleasure because pleasure wasn't going to contribute to your salvation. Whereas the medievals, it was quite a big part of life, you know. And also I think the medieval attitude was good because it was about good works all day long. So it wasn't like you just kind of did one thing, like got rid of the car and then you could carry on doing everything else guilt-free.
Mm.
It was a more kind of relaxed attitude to life. So what I'm trying to do in How to Be Free and... in my work generally, is carve out a new way of thinking where, yeah, we have got to sort of change our attitudes and our mental approach to work and to doing in general. But it doesn't have to mean a giving up. In fact, there's a whole embracing of a new world of pleasures that comes when you take responsibility and become self-sufficient or start taking some steps towards self-sufficiency.
Mm. I mean, the couple of the main themes that come out of the book, as far as I've read it so far, is you know, it's a strong attack on the job and the career, and also the idea of kind of consumerism. But yeah, balancing that with the kind of positive, you know, what do you put in place? Well, voluntary simplicity, maybe feasting, merriment, and companionship of kind of some of the themes that I'm getting from it. Would that be fair?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I think being cheerful and being merry are actually quite sort of political acts because we're told to worry about terrorism and now about global warming. There's a sort of atmosphere of concern, anxiety, what can be done that's promoted in the papers, which actually sort of makes people feel guilty and can lead to them sort of thinking, well, what's the point? You know, I'm just going to carry on.
Yeah.
I mean, what I found in my own life was actually financially motivated, because we were living down here in a rented farmhouse and had some, you know, financial problems, money worries, as they call it. And but it was sort of as a result of that that we started to do things like grow our own vegetables and whatever it is, and use the car less or whatever. And what we found was that far from being a kind of ascetic giving up of things, a sort of self-flagellating thing, a new world of pleasures opened up. I mean, it, you know, growing your own vegetables is more fun than buying them from the supermarket, yeah. And it's cheaper. Yeah. And I think that the financial argument is a really strong one, because as far as I can tell, if you reduce your annual outgoings, then you're also going to reduce your dependency on waged employment and on money. So it actually came not from a sort of moral conviction, although that's part of it. It just came from being strapped for cash, and then finding actually that being strapped for cash is not so bad.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing about the book is that it's so grounded in kind of historical precedents, if you like. There's an amazing bibliography at the end. And I'm just wondering if you could try and point out any way in which the kind of diverse range of people you've got in your bibliography, kind of all, what connects them?
Well, what connects them is a desire for freedom, I think. Mm. And opening up a dialogue about how to get it and what it is. Mm. And what I thought was useful in looking at these ideas in historical terms was firstly to show that people have been thinking along these lines for, you know, an awfully long time. So there's a tradition, a sort of an intellectual tradition. And it also teaches us, I think, looking at these things historically, that our attitudes are not innate. They're a result of the way we're brought up, they're a result of social conditioning. So a competitive worldview is not something in human nature. It's something that's developed over the last 300 or 400 years, particularly in northern European countries and in the States and stuff like that. Whereas what it replaced was actually a cooperative worldview. And that's the fascinating thing about the medieval age, because we most of us carry a caricature around of it in our heads, that it was, you know, sort of bad diet and leprosy and you know, sort of people dying at 25 or whatever. But actually there was a whole set of ethical values that motivated medieval man. And at the heart of it was a belief in the importance of community, and that the communal good was the most important thing. So I thought that was a useful lesson, if you like, and it's something that we need to bring back now, a belief in community and how community can actually be liberating.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you talk about Kropotkin, the Russian anarchist, and mutual aid and the kind of free city movement that he describes.
There was that great thing about the medieval city, and I can't remember the exact German, but the Germans had a phrase, city air makes you free. So it was a liberation, but from the sort of feudal situation in the countryside, and people actually moved out of that quite self-consciously and deliberately and created their own cities. But the key thing is that they were self-governed, so there wasn't a big central state. And, of course, you know, in lots of other ways, the medieval age was ecologically sound or friendly or whatever, because there was, you know, there were no cars. I mean, the pigs were the dustmen in Florence, and people had responsibility. So you didn't give up responsibility to the council or to a government to do things. For example, you cleaned up the area in front of your own house. So I think that there's a good lesson there as well.
Mm. I mean, a lot of work that people do is just unnecessary. The kind of supply chains have become so long, and there's so much processing and kind of packaging and waste.
Yeah, I think it's a really wasteful system. Yeah. There's a lot of unnecessary work created, partly because of this idea that it's better for people to be busy than to be doing nothing.
Yeah.
So that awful idea of job creation,
yeah.
Or the even worse idea of full employment. But yeah, I think a lot of it is unnecessary, and a lot of it comes from a sort of Puritan vanity, man's vanity. So you feel like you want to sort of make a mark on the world. But what sort of a mark are you making? And wouldn't it be better sort of not to make a mark on the world? And so there's something a bit nihilistic in the philosophy that I'm talking about as well. You know, nothing really matters. All man's striving is for nothing, because we're just kind of little specks and we're going to turn into dust before too long. So I think there's a kind of a vanity that leads people to do things, and it's almost like people think it's better to do something than to do nothing at all. You know, there's also the idea that the whole capitalist system is built on waste, and I think one of the nice things about the green movement is that it says don't waste. You know, so compost the vegetables or whatever it is, reuse, make your own stuff, and that seems to be very sensible from all sorts of points of view, from the point of view of pleasure in everyday life, from the point of view of not having to work so hard because your life is cheaper, and also of course for the longer term benefit of the planet.
Mm. And a lot of it is about making stuff for us to consume that we don't really need. I mean, Ivan Illich talks about imputed need, stuff that we actually kind of were taught to need in a sense by kind of advertising and stuff. And the more people work, the more people end up consuming. So it's a kind of vicious circle, isn't it?
Yeah, because everyone knows, let's say you've been unemployed for a while and you get a job or the dream job. It's great at first, and then after a few weeks or a few months, you're finding it all quite miserable and depressing because you feel sort of powerless. And so what do? You treat yourself. This idea, you know, because you're worth it. So you start spending on fun or, you know, methods of escape because you feel you deserve it because you've had a bad day at the office. But if you haven't had a bad day at the office, you don't need to spend the money. So I suppose that's another sense in which idleness can be eco-friendly and anti-consumerist, because you just don't feel the need to do it. I mean, in our own case, I think about holidays. It sounds a bit kind of miserable, but I've become quite anti-holiday, because a holiday is an escape or a little sort of reward 2 weeks of the year for your 50 weeks of toil in the dark satanic mills. And wouldn't it be better to be on holiday all the year round, and then you wouldn't feel that you needed to escape or needed to go on holiday?
Yes, that idea of kind of marrying up work and play as well, and your attitude to work, and kind of reintroducing creativity into what you do. That's another kind of theme in which you kind of
because I think work and, like lots of other things, work and play have been split, and that's why I don't like the phrase work-life balance that politicians use currently, because it basically implies that work is bad and life is good, and so you've got to sort of reduce the amount of work. Well, that could be a good first step, you know, like make your work part-time if you're not enjoying something, do less of it. But I think really the goal is to unite them, so your work and your life all mixed up together in a way that you can't separate the one from the other. And, you know, according to someone like E.P. Thompson, he wrote The Making of the British Working Class. That was actually the case before the Industrial Revolution. The rural smallholding, combined with one or two crafts, combined the two. You know, I mean, at home we've got chickens now and pigs. Now, is it work to go and feed the pigs and the chickens? No, it's really good fun, but it's also work and it's productive and it's doing something useful. So that's what I'm sort of aiming towards.
Mm. It's interesting that you mentioned shifting to part-time, because this whole idea, if people are kind of thinking about, well, you know, perhaps the job I'm in is A, boring and kind of soul-destroying, but B, probably not doing much good for the planet, and might have kind of undesirable social consequences in various aspects of what it does as a corporation, maybe. So if people are kind of rethinking about how to restructure their lives, going part-time is one option, and going freelance, I guess, is another thing.
Yeah, I think looking after yourself in different ways. I mean, there are other problems that come with being freelance or being self-employed. There's greater responsibility. You can't sort of sit around moaning so much. You've got to get on with it. Because there isn't a sort of boss figure to take out your frustrations on. You just have to do it yourself. And, you know, people are scared of that. Why are they scared? Because they've been told to be scared. But a lot of people say, well, I wouldn't be able to have the self-discipline to work for myself. But that's because we've been sort of brought up you know, by school and college and then the workplace, to believe that we need an employer to rely on for some kind of income. Mm. But what people find is when you do quit the job or at least go part-time, then your outgoings shrink or, you know, they could be halved. And you fall back on your own wits and you find that you do have some wits. And it's a wonderful feeling.
I guess another thing in the book is trying to disassemble all the psychological elements that kind of keep us entrapped. Can you outline some of the main ones and what you think are the kind of solutions?
Well, I talk about the mind-forged manacles, which is a phrase from William Blake. The idea that the manacles that we suffer from are created by our own minds. And therefore, if they're created by our own minds, then your mind can also take them off and free yourself from the manacles. And one of those is guilt. I mean, that's another thing, understanding I get from reading Nietzsche. Morals are created by man, usually in order to serve the interests of the powers that be. So it's actually quite easy to resist. So, I mean, guilt is one of those. I feel guilty for not working. But when you understand that that guilt has actually been produced by interests in history who want you to feel guilty for not working. I mean, for example, you know, when people move from the fields to the towns to the factories in the late 18th century, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there was a real need to communicate a new kind of morals, which was done largely by, through the Methodists. You know, God wants you to turn up on time. Because there was a new strictness about time that was coming in. You had to work by the clock rather than by the seasons. And so people were made to think that that was part of some kind of natural morality, when actually it was created by external forces and then imposed by various kind of brainwashing techniques.
Yeah, all these things have kind of become cultural norms, haven't they? They've become almost unquestionable.
Yeah, they've become cultural norms, but you only have to look at other societies around the world now, or other societies in history, to see that these ideas are a product of the culture, and they're not something that we're born with, they're not innate. I mean, you know, the Aborigines didn't feel the need to work 12 hours a day or anything like that. Once you have the necessities, then you can carry on with your feasting and dancing and so on.
Yeah, time is a crucial one, isn't it? I mean, you talk about the idea, you know, time is money, and that's become very kind of dominant. Unfortunately, a lot of people have taken this on, internalised this idea, and it's the way they think about their lives. But you've studied the kind of opposite or the inverse of that, haven't you, with this kind of study of idleness?
I think that time is money is a really good notion to abandon if you're trying to create a more enjoyable, sort of more free life for yourself. Because, it's just not true. Time isn't money, and I mean, in my own life, I have a whole variety of different activities, some of which I get paid for and some of which I don't. Because I don't think time is money. I mean, for example, I'm on the committee for our local music festival, and we're all volunteers, and it's a voluntary association. No one gets paid. Bands get paid to play, but the people who set it all up don't. We're doing it for its own sake, for its own pleasure. If you have the time is money idea in your mind, then that would just be a waste of time, because what's the point unless it actually earns you some cash? And in a very small way, growing a few of your own vegetables helps you to get out of that idea as well. The gardening is a completely different activity. It's enjoyable. It adds a new dimension to my life. And, it might save money looked at in a different way, because I'm not going to the supermarket to buy those vegetables. But, yeah, I think it's liberating to escape from the idea that time is money. And, again, the medievals didn't have that either, because they were very anti-usury. And they were anti the idea of lending money at interest. So in that sense, it was an anti-capitalist society. They traded, and there was a lot of business, but trade was conducted on different principles. You weren't allowed to compete, for example. And craftspeople gathered themselves into guilds, and the guilds set the prices of the products. And they also had rules against overwork and against undercutting, against competition, and all the things that we think are the sort of sine qua non of modern capitalist society were actually argued against, because, as in other areas of life, cooperation was the key dominant ethical principle rather than competition.
One thing you probably get a lot of is well, you know, if we all dropped out, what would happen to the economy? You know, what would happen to my mortgage? Do you get a lot of that? And do you have you must have constructed a sound response by now.
Yeah, I get that quite a lot. Well, it's all very well, but, you know, I need to earn money for my mortgage. The idea that, yeah, if we all did this, then the economy would grind to a halt. Well, we have done this sort of thing in the past, and, you know, the medieval age is an example of it. Economies don't grind to a halt. In fact, trade carries on, but it carries on in a sort of strangely more free way, even though there are more commercial controls. So you still have spice routes and fantastic purple silks being made in Florence and imported to England and this sort of thing. In fact, there was a hell of a lot of world trade in the 12th century, 12th and 13th centuries, and people were going all over the world trading, but they weren't conquering. So it was different. Again, there was a different sort of mindset behind it. And also, I think when it comes to idleness, I'm not actually telling everybody to stop working. I'm encouraging people to do what's in their minds already, really, which is take the reins of their own life and live it in the way that you created and which you enjoy. And I think if everyone did that, then people would be more independent and less reliant on large institutions, large governments and big business.
You described the supermarkets as evil, and so avoid those at all costs, and have kind of constructed some kind of practices for getting around that. You've got your own vegetable patch and considering brewing your own beer, is that right?
I did do it once, yeah, it wasn't a great success.
Okay.
But, you know, there's still obviously room for division of labour. You can't do everything, but I think we can do a lot more for ourselves. We can do more jobs around the house. If you've got a full-time job, which you specialise in one small thing to the exclusion of all others, again, you become dependent on the suppliers of those services elsewhere. So to me, it makes sense to become a more powerful person, more capable and more confident.
Yeah, and kind of probably kind of rediscovering old skills and that have kind of been lost, I guess, by people relying on other people doing a lot of stuff for
us. Yeah, it's not a romantic notion, because I get accused of, well, this is lovely and sort of fluffy and romantic, your idea of returning to the land. But, I mean, having a garden and growing some herbs and vegetables is completely a normal thing to do. There's nothing sort of weird and misty-eyed about it. It just makes a lot of practical sense, because it's right outside your back door. And even if you don't have a garden, you can get an allotment. I mean, this actually happened during the Second World War. Strangely, paradoxically, a lot of the things I'm talking about were encouraged by the government, and actually had a big effect. So there was something like 1.3 million allotments. There was a Dig for Victory campaign. And perhaps because of the sense of being attacked, people who were there and will say, and also you read in accounts, that it was a time when there were actually very strong bonded communities. And there had been a kind of an agricultural crisis before that. But now people are encouraged to keep rabbits, chickens, and grow their own vegetables. And lots of our grandfathers are still doing it because they realized it was such a pleasure. So when we were cut off from some of those international sort of trade routes because of the Second World War, we were encouraged to become self-sufficient. But then when they wanted everything to open out again, we were encouraged to go to the supermarket to encourage sort of global trade.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a lot of people that are thinking now that this kind of return to kind of locality and self-sufficiency, there's almost an inevitability about it, because you've got, on the one hand, you've got kind of oil peaking shortly, but also probably even more important than that, you've got to, you know, if we're to avoid the worst of climate change, we're going to have to stop our reliance on oil anyway.
I think it would be good to be less reliant on oil. I mean, on that issue, I do sometimes think we should stop going on about oil, because every time we talk about peak oil, or, you know, there's an oil crisis, then all the bosses of the oil companies are like, this is fantastic, because, you know, we can control the price better.
Yep.
I mean, I filled up my car the other day, and it's petrol's like over £1 a litre, whereas I'm sure a few months ago it was about 80p, and it's a massive increase.
Yeah.
So
they are raking in the biggest profits ever, aren't they? Corporate profits, the oil companies.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it doesn't surprise me. I mean, I sometimes think, you know, one reason that eco issues the green movement has become so popular recently is because businesses have suddenly realised it's actually quite good for them.
Mm.
I mean, there was a whole issue of The Economist devoted to it, why it's all good for business, because it means new products, new developments, you know, new jobs, new factories, etc., etc. Yeah, I'm sort of, I don't know, I feel ambivalent about the idea of worrying about oil. I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense for individuals to cut down on it, because the alternatives are actually more enjoyable. They're more fun. Wood, you know, growing trees. I mean, one thing I think would be nice if people who are in cities who need to get out for a break to sort of get back to nature, we could buy a wood. And you can get woods for about, you can get like sort of 5 or 6 acres of woods for £20,000. Now, if you've got a few families together or a community to chip in, it's not beyond the stretches of the world's imagination that for the price of a plasma TV, you could get access to a wood, you know, sort of every other weekend for most of the year. And then you could manage that wood. You could have wild parties in the wood and camp in the wood and in the fields. You could have vegetables there, and you could also cut down wood for your home heating needs.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think it does make sense to cut down oil because it's so expensive. And as I said earlier, if your outgoings are less, then you don't have to work so hard. I mean, it struck me yesterday, we drove about half an hour to the beach when actually we got a beach on much closer that we could have walked down to. But so to me it was a bit sort of crazy that everyone chunders out of wherever they are for a family break, a family day out or a family weekend. Well, actually, there's a whole world of pleasures to be enjoyed right on our doorsteps.
That was Tom Hodgkinson, editor and co-founder of The Idler magazine, whose latest book, highly readable and paradigm-shifting, How to Be Free, has just been published in paperback by Penguin. That's it for this week's Low Carbon Show. If you're hungry for more, check out the Climate Radio archive at climateradio.co.uk.
Where there are hills, they're not just called hills, they're really hills. And there are places where there are forests, not like 12 pines, but really forests. There are places where the birds sing, you can hear the eagle call. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond them all. Where there are rivers, not surrounded by concrete, but living rivers with fish in them and frogs and little tadpoles, with ducks and deer drinking by the sinkholes. There are places far away, the trees turn colors in the fall. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond them all. You can see the sky, not neon signs and billboards, but just the sky. There are places with dirt on the ground, without miles of asphalt, not a car around. Where on and in the soil, good little critters crawl. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond them all. There are places like that, and things don't have to be like this. I mean, not just cosmetic changes, things really don't have to be like this. There are places where people know their neighborhood, where people live there, and they think that life is good. There are places like that, somewhere on this spinning ball. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond them all. I've got to find, otherwise I will undoubtedly lose my mind. Otherwise I'll end up just like you on Ritalin or Prozac or whatever things you do. I'm going where the water is blue and the trees are oh so tall. I know they're out there, somewhere beyond them all. Thank you.
them all. Our political system was designed to impede drastic changes to the status quo. As that status quo is the domination of financial interests, those trying to save our environment face special challenges. The nature of environmental destruction is that it is irreversible, or at least irreversible within any human timescale. An old-growth forest, badly polluted land, air, and water, species extinction, climate instability. This desperate state of affairs has spurred militant action on the part of many, especially young activists. These people, who ought to be lauded as heroes, are pursued by the authorities as if they were the most dangerous of criminals. And from the point of corporate rule, they are. Challenging as they do, the sacred right to profits, uber alles. A multi-year FBI manhunt has resulted recently in the imprisonment of a group of people involved in sabotage in the Northwest, who have come to be known as the Green Scare Defendants. Next, Matt Soltes of Healing the Earth in Guelph, Ontario, speaks with Lauren Regan, a public interest attorney in Eugene, Oregon, who's been involved in representing Green Scare activists, who have been labeled by the government as the number one domestic terrorist threat. Matt begins by asking Lauren to explain the background behind the Green Scare cases.
The Green Scare, in essence, probably started back in 2001 or 2002. Most people didn't really realize that the FBI had begun really investigating, infiltrating, and surveilling the environmental movement in a desperate attempt to find any linkage or evidence regarding a series of arsons that occurred from 1997 to 2001. And these were arsons of empty buildings, or in a couple cases, they were arsons of SUVs. In many instances, there was graffiti accrediting the crimes to the Earth Liberation Front or the Animal Liberation Front, and sometimes other liberation fronts as well were mentioned by name. The oldest crimes from 1996 and 1997 were coming up on their 10-year statute of limitations, which would have meant that if they had not prosecuted those crimes, they never would have been able to prosecute them. And so there was a lot of motivation and a lot of energy being placed by law enforcement and the FBI in trying to solve these unsolved crimes. And during the 2002-2003 time period, numerous grand jury subpoenas were being issued, not only in the Northwest, but around the country. And a lot of those subpoenas were coming down in Eugene, Oregon, my town. And so we were kind of at ground zero for dealing with another round of grand jury subpoenas to activists and community members who did not wish to cooperate with the government in its investigation. And, of course, because grand juries are so secret, the government did not disclose what they were actually investigating, whether they were investigating one fire, all fires, or whatnot. Primarily, the grand juries were showing people numerous photographs of, you know, 99% of the pictures were of totally law-abiding people. But the U.S. attorney would show these various photographs and ask the person to identify the photograph, you know, who it was, who the person was, what they were involved with, whether they were active, what their political views were, et cetera, et cetera. It was pretty much the definition of a witch hunt. And the government was not getting any closer to solving any of these crimes by haranguing and, you know, bringing in all of these individuals. There was an unusual emphasis in the first round of grand juries on women from our community with children who were being subpoenaed. And, of course, they didn't know anything about the crimes or anyone involved in these arsons, but they were susceptible individuals in that there was a lot of pressure put on these women to cooperate with the government and to testify at these grand jury hearings or face the threat of jail and incarceration, which, of course, if you have a young child, is you know, a very, very difficult choice to make. And so the government first began to sort of break the ranks, so to speak, by issuing these grand jury subpoenas and then bringing these individuals in under threat of incarceration. And that went on for many years. And Jake Ferguson, who is the lead informant in this case and the man responsible for sort of blowing up the case for the police, Jake Ferguson was also one of those individuals that was subpoenaed during that time period. We actually assisted him in making sure that he had an attorney, and he was heavily using heroin at this time and was a really unhealthy individual. And apparently sometime between 2003 and 2005, Mr. Ferguson cracked under pressure, I guess would be the way to say it, and he had his attorney voluntarily go to the FBI and say, give me a large sum of money, give me immunity, and I'll give you what you want, information about these cases. And of course, the FBI at that point really had no clue a pot of gold that they had just struck upon Jake Ferguson. But they, of course, quickly agreed to the deal. And as a result of his initial disclosures to the government about his involvement in over 20 separate arsons, he admitted that he'd been setting arson since he was 8 years old. He began giving the names of numerous other people that he was associated with, and then ultimately the government began setting him up with a wire and flying him around the country to incriminate and coerce other people into making admissions for involvement that they had in this ELF-ALF conspiracy.
Wow.
That's the early days. And then December of 2005 was the first arrests of the first seven individuals that were taken into custody and accused of arson, conspiracy to commit arson.
Can you also talk about some of the legal tactics which have emerged beyond just people wearing wires and stuff like that?
Sure. The government in this case has conducted itself by using, you know, for lack of a better word, the COINTELPRO rule book. If history could repeat itself, it certainly has in this instance. And basically, the government brought out all its tools and tricks of the trade. It planted false information in communities. It went through people's garbage cans. It infiltrated lawful meetings and organizations. It planted provocateurs in community groups. And when the initial arrests were made of those seven people, the government grossly overcharged those individuals and basically threatened them with life sentences. And it was through using the threat of spending the rest of your life in prison for an act of sabotage or property damage that ultimately led to a number of the other cooperating defendants to turn federal witness. When Stan Meyerhoff was initially arrested, they brought Jake Ferguson to Virginia, where the arrest happened, and walked Meyerhoff past Ferguson so that they could have a little conversation, and Ferguson could basically tell Meyerhoff that the gig was up. And that led to Meyerhoff waiving his rights to an attorney, waiving all of his rights to not incriminate himself, and, you know, as the reports have indicated, within hours he had fully given up himself and others and had become a federal informant. And it snowballed from there. People like Gerlach and Kevin Tubbs probably would have held out and probably would have tried to have solidarity with the non-cooperating defendants, but for the fact that they were threatened with life plus 300 years, life plus 500 years, et cetera, et cetera. And even though that this is a tactic that's been used over and over again with resistance movements, this particular movement seemed to have forgotten its history pretty quickly and succumbed to that kind of pressure. But not all of them, of course, because the four non-cooperating defendants in Oregon were also facing those types of sentences. Joanna Zocker and Nathan Block were both facing life plus 1,115 years for their roles as lookouts in two separate arsons in this case. But yet, you know, they never wavered from their non-cooperation stance and refused to provide information about political movements to the government.
And what about the different ways the cooperating defendants have been treated throughout their sentencings compared with the non-cooperating defendants? It seems like the non-cooperators almost got less time than some of the cooperating defendants.
Well, there's multiple reasons for that. I mean, number one, the four non-cooperating defendants were some of the least culpable and least charged defendants in the case. All of the non-cooperating defendants were only involved in two separate arsons, and Jonathan Paul was involved in one arson, compared to Gerlach, Tubbs, and Meyerhoff, you know, the three primary informants who were involved in over a dozen arsons each. So, you know, that obviously has something to do. I mean, given the fact that Chelsea Gerlach was involved in over 12 arsons and toppling the Bonneville Power Towers, the fact that she only got 9 years speaks to the extent of her cooperation with the government.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure we'll probably talk about the terrorist enhancement in a little bit, but. You know, all of these people basically were looking at life sentences prior to the terrorist enhancement even being discussed or applied. And then when that terrorist enhancement was thrown into the mix, all of a sudden, you know, these individuals, when they committed these crimes, it was prior to 9/11 and it was prior to the passage of the Patriot Act. So even if they had you know, discussed or thought about what the potential implications of their crimes were, none of them could have anticipated that, you know, Bush Incorporated would have tried to label them as terrorists in this post-9/11 fear-mongering society. So, you know, there were a lot of political winds that also came into play with these cases. But you know, and I think that's also just another traditional COINTELPRO type tactic, is to grossly overcharge people to scare the bejesus out of them so that they are more likely to recant and to incriminate others, to, you know, so you know, leave the movement, turn their back on the people that they knew and worked with for years, and basically become federal informants. So they did get substantially less jail time, but it was very, very clear that the government and the court both saw the duties of a defendant in this current democracy not to uphold their right to an attorney, their right to not incriminate themselves. It appeared in 2007, the way the court views our justice system is that you are supposed to automatically waive those rights and that every criminal defendant is just automatically supposed to be a puppet for the government. And so she did give lectures and chastised the non-cooperating defendants. She said things like, you can't have your cake and eat it too, and, you know, other comments that basically made it very, very clear that the government and the court system was there to reward those that became snitches and to punish the non-cooperators, not only because they failed to cooperate, but also to scare the rest of the courtroom and to scare the rest of the movement into any idea that they might stand up for themselves as well. You know, they use the phrase martyr, you know, you're not a hero, you're not a martyr. And I don't think any of the non-cooperating defendants thought that they were martyrs or thought that they were heroes, but they just did what they thought was right. They had principles and ethics that was just, you know, they were unable to put those moral values aside in order to save their own rears or to somehow reduce their jail time. And, you know, I think that that generally, historically makes sense. I mean, people who have committed their lives to protecting the environment or stopping animal cruelty, you know, to then just completely do a 360, turn your back on those values and become a participant with a government that continues to perpetuate environmental destruction and animal cruelty is really just kind of giving up everything that you, you know, believed or worked for, which is a lot to ask.
Mm-hmm. And can we talk about this terrorism enhancement you've mentioned?
Sure. The terrorist enhancement under the federal sentencing guidelines is a mechanism by which the government can increase a prison sentence for particular crimes. And this is the first time in the history of the United States that the federal government has sought this enhancement for property crimes that did not result in injury or death to humans. That basically the government is attempting to equate property destruction with terrorism. And even more troubling, out of 20 incidents in this case, the government sought the terrorist enhancement on each and every arson that occurred. But the judge only found that the terrorist enhancement applied in 4 of those incidents. Half of them, however, were corporate property. One was an SUV dealership. Apparently, burning SUVs is now the equivalent of a terrorist act in this country, the equivalent of flying planes into buildings and killing humans. The other instance where corporate property equated to a terrorist act was the Jefferson Poplar tree plantation, which was a plantation of genetically engineered trees. And a shop and some equipment was burned in that incident, and the court found that that incident, too, was an act of terrorism. And the reasoning for that one was even more bizarre. The court ruled that because that arson took place on the same day as a University of Washington Horticulture Center arson, that the two were basically the same, and because the University of Washington arson was a quote-unquote government building, then Jefferson Poplar could be equated that same way. And many individuals received the terrorist enhancement for that arson based on that reasoning, which very well may be appealed. The most bizarre part about the terrorist enhancement, though, is the mechanism that was used. All along, we've been saying that the government's attempt at using this terrorist enhancement was political, that they were simply trying to label these individuals as terrorists for political gain. And the government continued to object to that and say, oh, this case isn't political, we're not just trying to label them. But this really is probably one of the most shallow defenses you could ever imagine. I mean, basically, what the government did is, you know, because these people didn't have any prior convictions for the most part, you would have expected their sentences to be fairly low, like 3 to 5 years. But when the terrorist enhancement was added, their sentences quadrupled, and many of them were looking at over 100 years in jail as a result of the terrorist enhancement. But what did the government do then? It then offered downward departures of an equal amount so that the ultimate sentence ended up being that same 3 to 5 year range. So basically, they shot the sentence up through the roof, but then dropped it back down to where it started to begin with. And so that the people ended up with basically the same amount of years in jail as they would have without the sentence, but now they will be labeled a terrorist for the rest of their lives in this country. And not only will they have that label affixed to them, but it also indicates that they will most likely face very serious security housing when they go into the Bureau of Prisons and when they start serving their prison time. They will, you know, normally we would have expected these individuals to be in white-collar type prisons with nonviolent offenders, first-time offenders, et cetera, because that's what their criminal histories indicated. But now, as a result of having the terrorist enhancement applied to most of them, they'll be looking at going to maximum security facilities with some of the most violent offenders in the country.